agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by Chase Law professor Ken Katkin. Hey, Ken.
Oh, hey, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing okay. And, you know, normally, of course, Ken would be doing the show with Trey, but as regular listeners know, Trey has been, well, doing battle, I guess, both with kind of a significant flare in his autoimmune condition, as well as with his insurance company. And, you know, he's been through a lot since he was diagnosed. And geez, I guess it's been around 2 years now. The last few months, though, have been really challenging for Trey. And so just as a reminder, any new listener donations we get in the month of December, they're going to be going to Trey to support him during it's a pretty tough time. And also in recognition of all he's done over the last couple of years, battling this under some really, really tough conditions. And you'd never know it by listening to the repartee between Trey and Ken on the show. I can only do my best to try to recreate even a part of that, Ken, but I will do my level best. So, and we do it. We have a lot going on. Some of it's going to bleed over into our midweek bonus show. We're going to be talking about Kristen Sinema leaving the Democratic Party, the Warnock beating Walker in Georgia. It's a pretty bad week for Donald Trump on a number of fronts. The Democratic National Committee changing the primary system and a whole bunch more stuff. We'll get to whatever we can, and we will start off at that in just 1 second. Okay, Ken, so I thought we'd start with the fact that WNBA player Brittany Griner is now back in the United States following the successful conclusion of a prisoner swap in which the U.S. returned convicted arms dealer Victor Bout to Russia. Now, Griner had been in Russian custody for 10 months while Bout had served 10 years out of a 25-year sentence for arms trafficking. And there was some hope that these negotiations might include Paul Whelan, who had been in Russian custody since 2018. And he was convicted of espionage charges, as well as Mark Fogel, a history teacher who's been detained since August of 2021 for charges that are pretty similar to Griner's. He had a small amount of marijuana in his possession for chronic back pain following spinal surgery. And in June of this year, Fogel was sentenced to 14 years at a Russian labor camp. So, Ken, what do you think about the prisoner swaps in general and this one in particular?
You know, it's not something I've given a ton of thought to. So you'll be getting my kind of extemporaneous thoughts, which I could certainly be persuaded to change because I don't have firm opinions on this. But and in fact, I'm even going to admit my views on this are probably shaped by my general trust in the present administration. Like, I think I would have been more critical if it had been a different administration. So I just want to admit my kind of, you know, partisan bias there. But I feel like just not being someone with expertise in this area, it does seem to me like the Biden administration showed what I believe is its usual good judgment in you know, kind of thinking about the costs and benefits here. And obviously there are both, right? It's good that a U.S. citizen who I think was, you know, very harshly and unjustly detained in Russia for largely political reasons was brought home. You know, of course, that we paid a pretty high price for it. And I think from a lot of people's perspectives, you know, Russia got the better end of the bargain in a certain sense. And so the question would be, is it good for us to make a bargain like that? Even if, you know, one could say they got the better of it, you know, was it still enough of a win-win that that we should do it? And it seems to me like, yes. You know, I know it symbolically looks bad to let this guy out, who's a very serious arms dealer who possibly could play a role in helping Putin commit further abuses. But really, he's already served 10 years in prison here. There's other people like him who could play that role in Russia. It seems hard for me to believe that his personal presence there is going to have any really significant impact on what Putin is able to do or not do. And of course, it's accompanied by stepping up our support for Ukraine as best we can in the present military engagements and in geopolitical diplomacy. So I think generally good. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I guess there are two ways I look at this. I agree with you about, I think, especially given the fact that he's been out of the arms dealing game for a decade, a little bit more actually than that. I mean, connections and networks and things change. And so I think his utility to Putin is going to be limited, I guess. And as you point out, other people are providing those sort of services. Certainly they filled that void. So on that end, I mean, yeah, Russia got a better deal. I guess I don't blame. I'm happy Brittany Griner is back. I think it was a huge injustice, and that's a great thing. But I guess when I think about not Fogel, but the Paul Whelan, who there's espionage charges and there's some other stuff going on there potentially with Whelan. But when I take a look at Mark Fogel, who it seems to me that the situation is very, very similar to Griner's, except he's an older person who's, I wouldn't be surprised, is maybe less able to withstand the rigors of a Russian labor camp. He's been in custody longer, and yet the State Department hasn't even bothered to list him as being unlawfully imprisoned, despite the fact that this August, 9 senators petitioned the Secretary of State to do so. And this was a bipartisan thing, 6 Democrats, 3 Republicans. And it feels to me like in this, like in everything else, it pays to be a well-connected celebrity because, you know, Fogel's just some history teacher from Pittsburgh. And, oh, well, Brittany Griner gets to go to the front of the line because she's, you know, semi-famous. And I have a problem with that.
Yeah, I just don't know enough about that. And I was pleading that this is really something sure. I didn't know that much about. But I guess I don't even know that the State Department isn't making efforts to get Mark Fogel out. And I don't know enough about the details of his case and why, if you're saying the State Department hasn't listed it as an injustice, I'm not sure why they haven't. So maybe if you know more about that, maybe I'm not the only one who doesn't. Maybe you could tell me and our listeners.
Yeah, and they haven't. In fact, at the press conference, I think it was yesterday, the White House press secretary sort of sidestepped all the questions about directly the comparisons to the Fogel case. Now, they did earlier on, I think this summer, they did ask Russia to release Fogel on humanitarian grounds, but they have been strangely silent in response to why they felt that the Griner case was an injustice, which I agree it was, but why the Fogel case is different. And it's just in absence of any other information from the State Department, it's hard. I think it's understandable for people to say, well, look at you have a wealthy, connected celebrity. And then you have a history teacher from Pittsburgh. And, well, of course, wealthy, connected celebrities always seem to be able to jump the line. And that's what I'm left with, because the State Department says they won't comment. The White House says they won't comment because of security issues and safety issues. And maybe that's the case. Or maybe it's just a convenient cover for saying, like, hey, it looked politically better for us to free this person who a lot of folks care about, as opposed to this guy who no one even hardly knows about.
Yeah, I understand that issue now. I mean, I guess, you know, we again, I don't know that anybody knows that the State Department isn't working to get this guy Fogel mm-hmm. out. You know, they're not commenting about it. And I think there's a lot of people who, you know, anytime Biden does anything, there's people that want to find a way to, you know, criticize him for that. And so, you know, this seems like maybe the wedge into criticizing this deal. But I still think that the swap for Brittany Griner, it's better that he did it than that he not do it, right? I mean, if we have a binary choice here, he can swap out for this one celebrity, or he could not swap out for this one celebrity. I think it's better to do it, even if there's another person similarly situated that he wasn't also able to swap out for. And I think it doesn't end any behind the scenes efforts that might be being made. And I also think about it, if the administration is making efforts to get Mark Fogel out, it's probably necessary that they be as tight-lipped about it as they are, because the more they sort of publicly say they're trying to do it, the more that increases the price that Putin can extract for it, because
sure.
he gets the ability to make the administration, kind of publicly fail. You know, so I think it's absolutely necessary to keep quiet about it if they're working on it.
Yeah, and I agree that the difficulty here, of course, is there is an awful lot that we don't know. And I would agree with you that if it's a case where Putin said, hey, listen, it's Griner for Bout, and that's the only deal that we're willing to consider. Well, yes, I certainly wouldn't want the Biden administration or any administration to say, no, we're holding out for this guy who's been here longer. So yeah, under those, if it were a binary choice, definitely I certainly agree with that. I mean, there's also the issue of, well, is it good policy in general to do prisoner swaps? And I think while many administrations in the past have said, well, we don't negotiate with terrorists. I would argue that Russia's a terrorist state. That's another question. But I get that in practice, it's just simply not something we can afford not to do when we have someone who we have a potential of bringing home.
Right. I mean, it's literally the way we brought home all the Iranian hostages in 1980. Yeah. I mean, there's such a compelling humanitarian case to do some kind of negotiating. And also, I think even though, you know, a lot of people have noted, and I won't disagree, you know, that we're giving them back a much more serious criminal and a much more person who's more high value to Putin than what we're getting back. You know, I think that it's possible for one side to get the better end of a deal at the same time that the deal is a win-win for both sides. Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of like that every single time I go, you know, buy some ice cream, really. You know, I think like Raiders gets a lot more out of that deal than I do, but it's still a win-win.
And honestly, I'm happy. I'm okay with giving Russia a propaganda victory that's not really a substantive win if it means bringing an American back home.
Yeah, me too.
So, all right. Well, let's move on to the domestic front. Some other late breaking news. Earlier today, we're recording this late Friday morning. Earlier today, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced she was leaving the Democratic Party and becoming an independent. And in an op-ed that appeared in the Arizona Republic, Sinema wrote that she had promised Arizona voters that she'd be independent when she was elected into the Senate in 2018. That she's worked with both parties and that she has, in her words, joined a growing number of Arizonans who reject party politics by declaring my independence from the broken partisan system in Washington. Now, Sinema said that she'll keep her Democratic Party committee positions and she won't caucus with the GOP. So my take is that this is unlikely to have any significant, at least short-term, policy ramifications, although the media is calling it an earthquake and other headline clickbaity kind of things like that. I don't know. Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree 100%. The implications are all only about the 2024 elections. But in the immediate run, you know, what it actually does is continue a kind of peculiar aspect of the status quo that ever since the 2020 elections, there have been more Republican senators than Democratic senators in the Senate. But yet the Democrats have had the majority. And, you know, because Sanders and King are independent already. Right. So we were talking about the last Senate. Most people called it a 50-50 Senate, but it was actually a 50-48 Senate with two independents. And now, you know, it looked like maybe the Dems were going to tie that up at 49-49, but get the advantage because the two independents would caucus with them. I think now you could say, well, the Republicans actually have 49-48. But yet the Dems still have the majority because they have the three independents. So I feel like there's literally no impact in present on present functioning of the Senate. Nobody even thinks about Sanders or King as anything other than Democrats in terms of the functioning of the Senate. And they are independents. And I think that's just the category that Sinema has moved herself into.
Yeah. You know, I agree. And I think, though, it's maybe smart politically for Sinema. She's, you know, looking ahead to a primary challenge in 2024. And I can see where she'd say, well, I don't see how I win in a Democratic primary. And so I can't win in a Republican primary. And if she wants to get reelected, maybe she thinks her best chance is to run as an independent, hope that the Democrats and Republicans split enough of the vote so she comes out on top. And it's better to do that now than right before the 2024 primary season. I think it seems less kind of craven and calculated and that sort of thing, and kind of gives voters a little more time to sort of adjust to that reality. So politically, I think it might be the smartest move for Sinema if she actually wants to keep her seat.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, actually, I think she may be thinking that way, but I would put that down to her insane narcissism and magical thinking. I think there's no chance that she can get reelected in 2024 under any circumstances. And, you know, she may have already seen that she can't get renominated as a Democrat and that she can't get nominated as a Republican, as you just said. And I think she may believe, therefore, that her path to keeping the seat is as an independent. I don't believe that's a path to keeping the seat either. I don't think she'll have a lot of juice for that run. You know, I think it's the problem she has in Arizona is that the there's a lot of Republicans in Arizona who really do want to run, and they're not going to clear a path for her and let her run as an independent and only put in a token, you know, Republican candidate. There's going to be a real Republican candidate who's really running. And so she's not going to get enough Republican votes or Democratic votes to be viable. Her Senate career is over. But I think the two things she gets out of this, one is the that she can keep this magical thinking alive that she will run in 24. But the other is that she is such an extreme narcissist that I think the main benefit she gets out of it is she's kind of being talked about today, which she wouldn't otherwise. Yeah. And she's in fact being talked about as playing some kind of kingmaking role, which she wouldn't be otherwise. And I think it's just her unbelievable narcissism that's the primary driver of all this.
She is a fascinating character. I mean, here's someone who's right. She's raised a Mormon, then she leaves the church, starts to identify as bisexual. And earlier on in his career, she calls herself a Prada socialist. And now she's just all over the map. And I think, more than the usual amount of narcissism, even for a United States senator, which is, you know, saying quite a lot. I would say, yeah. But I will say,
I think that's the formula for understanding everything you need to know about Kristen Sinema.
Well, but I will say kind of in her defense, in a way, I mean, on one hand, you can say, well, you know, she's voted with the administration less often than all but four Democrats in the Senate. But if you take a look at where Arizona is electorally, and there's a metric that actually 538 uses called Biden plus minus, which is basically the difference between a senator's predicted votes and their actual support for the administration based on Biden's margin in 2020. And she's way up there, actually. And so you could make the case that actually Kristen Sinema has been supporting the administration more than might be strictly good for her electorally. That's about the strongest case I'm going to make for Kristen Sinema, but I thought I would throw that out there since we've been more or less kind of bashing her throughout the segment here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll even pick a bone with that because, she has been supporting the administration much more often than not, but still I'd say not even as much as Mark Kelly. And Mark Kelly, I think, is stronger electorally than she is. So I Arizona is a purple state, but one of the best paths for a Democrat to win there is to consolidate the support of all the Democrats who are there.
Yep.
And that's what Kelly has really done.
Yeah. And Kelly has been slightly more supportive, you're right, of the administration in obviously the same state, so the same political environment. And he's much less of a insane narcissist, I guess you could say, certainly, than Sinema. So your prediction then is that Sinema is gone in 2024, and that while this may be a slim path, it's pretty much unlikely for her to have any kind of realistic shot.
Yeah, that's my prediction. I've actually made that prediction on the Politics Guys before, even before she announced that she was going to go independent. I think she has no path to reelection.
Yeah. And I think she's also suggested, or there have been suggestions people have asked her about, of all things, she'll like this, the presidency, right? And she said she has no plans or anything like that. But now if you take insane narcissism to the next level, you could see where someone in her position would say, well, maybe in 2028, I might have a shot as kind of the great independent hope, that sort of thing. Or would that be too out there even for Kristen Sinema? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out.
You know, she might believe it in the same kind of way that I think Liz Cheney believes that she could end up being a Republican
right.
presidential
yeah.
nominee. But I think, I think Liz Cheney's thinking is more realistic than Kristen Sinema's because, you know, I don't think Trumpism will completely blow over, but if Trumpism completely blows over, then Liz Cheney will have a shot to be the Republican nominee. But I don't see what possible change like that you could say if this would happen, then Kristen Sinema would have a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I'm inclined to believe that her career as a senator is probably nearing its end. We'll see. All right. Let's see here. Well, you know, let's stick with the Senate, Ken, and talk a little bit about how Senate Democrats this week, right? They got a little bit of breathing room on Tuesday. Incumbent Raphael Warnock beats Republican challenger Herschel Walker 51.4 to 48.6%. And by the way, if you're keeping track at home, Warnock's win means that every single Senate incumbent running for re-election won. And this is, as far as I can tell, the first time this has happened since voters have begun directly electing senators. So kind of a big first. And it's also, of course, the last in a series of pretty high profile Trump endorsees who've lost races that I think you could argue would have been far more winnable for less, I'll call them, polarizing nominees. So, Ken, how much do you think Warnock's win matters in a real sense?
Well, you know, I would think about both. We were just talking about Kelly as well. I would think about both Warnock and Kelly as illustrative of the extreme importance of candidate quality. You know, I think both Georgia and Arizona were close enough and are close enough. I would not call them Democratic states, but yet Democrats won in both of those states. And I think in both cases, it really was the disparity in candidate quality. And Warnock just did a terrific job, and I think that's why he was able to win in what I would say still looks like a Republican state. I mean, Kemp won the governor's race with, you know, running away with it. It wasn't even close. And and yet Warnock has now won, you know, four times if you in just a few years, if you count that he was first past the post in both the November elections as well as winning both the runoff elections. So to me, the big message there is candidate quality matters.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And Mitch McConnell has been saying that for quite a while, and to the derision of Donald Trump initially. But, you know, I can certainly envision a scenario in which the Republicans ended up with, you know, 54 seats in the Senate in January of 2023, looking forward to potentially a filibuster proof majority in 2025, and none of that's going to happen thanks to largely Donald Trump. So thank you, Donald Trump.
But also thanks to the Republican electorate, because
sure,
the low quality of the candidates they got actually does reflect the voters that vote for those low quality of candidates in their primaries. It wasn't like it was just stolen, you know, from the real Republican primary voters. I mean, these were reflective of the real Republican primary voters.
Right. And in a real sense, and I think this is something you pointed out a little while back on the show, it matters for one thing, because Sinema will probably end up caucusing with the Democrats. So that 51 to 49 effective margin means that Democrats have a majority on every committee, which means that they have subpoena power. And that could be potentially a big deal, as well as that means they also get a larger share of the budget. So that's a smaller thing, but still not entirely insignificant. And that's something that you think, that subpoena power might potentially come into play in the 118th Congress, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the two biggest practical impacts of having 51 versus 50, the main one is the subpoena power, which was very difficult for committees to wield when they were evenly divided. There were very complex procedures for getting to do that, and there was a lot of opportunities for the Republicans to derail it. The other one is appointments, that similarly, although the if a committee split on recommending a nominee for a floor vote, there were mechanisms to dislodge the matter from the committee and bring it to the floor, but those were slow and cumbersome methods. But I think now, you know, there will be much more streamlined process, because the committees are all going to have one more Democrat than Republican. That President Biden's nominees, both for judicial positions and for executive positions, are going to sail right to the floor, and they're not filibusterable on the floor. So I'm optimistic that he'll be able to fill all the judicial vacancies, and that there will be zero judicial vacancies by the time his term ends in the end of 2024. So that's the main significance. I think from a legislative standpoint, it make a lot less difference.
Yeah. Do you think that, I agree in terms of the ease, a greater ease of filling those judicial vacancies, especially. Do you think that having that one extra vote? Do you think that matters in terms of substantively the sort of judges Joe Biden will be able to get approved by the Senate, or really not that much in any real sense?
Not that much in any real sense for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, Biden himself is not trying to appoint far left judges. I think he's trying to, appoint the kind of judges with conventionally excellent credentials. He really won't find too many variances from that. And second of all, of course, you know, Manchin could still vote no on anybody. And, Manchin has voted no on a couple of executive nominations in the first 2 years of Biden's presidency. I don't think he's voted no on any judges, but I think he does have some need to establish some independence from Biden. So it won't be great if they can't keep all 51 senators on board. The idea that they have one to lose is formally true, but I think they're not looking to lose that one. I think they're planning to keep all those votes on board.
Yeah, that's my take as well. All right, well, before we get into Donald Trump's very bad week, or fairly bad week, I guess, in a little bit more detail, we will just take a quick break and then be right back. Okay, Ken, so, you know, it was, by any standard, I think it was kind of a rough week for Donald Trump. I mean, not only does his Georgia Senate candidate lose, but two subsidiaries of the Trump Organization were convicted of multiple crimes, including tax fraud, falsifying business records, and conspiracy. And these charges relate to the company compensating executives off the books in various ways, in order to evade taxes. Now, Donald Trump himself was not charged, but the organization is now subject to a fine of up to $1.6 million at sentencing, which will be coming in the next few weeks, I think. And of course, $1.6 million would be a lot to me. I'd be in trouble, but it doesn't really amount to that much for the Trump organization. But maybe of more significance to Donald Trump personally is that ongoing investigation by special counsel Jack Smith. And this week it was reported that Smith has sent subpoenas to election officials in Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin. Those, of course, are three closely contested states in 2020, and they played an important role in Trump's attempts to reverse the result of the 2020 presidential election. So Ken, I thought we could start with those Trump Organization convictions. I mean, what do you think about them? How big of a deal do you see those as being?
No, I think the crimes that the Trump Organization was convicted of are pretty minor. I'm even open to the idea that, you know, other New York corporations that committed similar violations of law, you know, might not find themselves being criminally prosecuted for it. Although also, it's probably also the case that those other organizations, if they were called on it or indicted for it, they would move faster to, you know, pay up the unpaid taxes yeah. and not go to the criminal trial. So, I think part of the reason we're seeing a criminal trial is there was more scrutiny into Trump Organization. But part is that, when the irregularities were revealed, he would not do a single thing to try to settle the matter. I think it is somewhat significant, you know, the fact that he's the Trump Organization has been convicted does leave open the possibility that he could be personally indicted, because now you have, you know, Alan Weisselbeck was convicted. The organization was convicted. It certainly suggests that Trump personally had knowledge of the scheme and may have ordered the scheme, because it, you know, after all, if Weisselbeck didn't do it, if Weisselbeck did it all himself, then there'd be no basis to convict the organization. So convicting the organization implies other people in the organization were in on it. So I think that does open a little bit of jeopardy for Trump. It does also open some additional room for penalties, not only the fines, but corporations that commit crimes can lose certain privileges going forward, even their right to operate as a New York corporation. So, that might not be a huge setback for him, but it would be another day that he'd be in the headlines if the Trump Organization lost its status as a New York corporation. So little things like that. But I think the biggest significance, of course, is political. And it's part of a week where, you know, he was a little bit humiliated by Herschel Walker losing in Georgia. He was a little bit humiliated by the blowback from his dinner with Kanye and the white supremacist Nick Fuentes. And it does feel like the independent counsel's net is closing. So, or the special counsel, not the independent counsel. So all, you know, all of those things are happening at once. And I think that adds up to a picture of Trump in political and legal jeopardy, and that all the dots that are forming that picture, you know, of which the convictions are one, I think the significance is mainly political.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and Jay has long said that his vision, his hope, I think, is that this aura of Trump being a winner after loss after loss after loss is just going to basically fall away, and he'll lose enough of his support so that at least if he can still make a run, he just won't have enough support to make a successful run. And I think there's maybe something to that, but I am hesitant to rule Donald Trump and his supporters out at this point, just because as I've said before, I was burned so badly in 2016 on that. So I'm not gonna say that Donald Trump is done at this point. But I did want to ask you about those Smith subpoenas, because I think on one hand you could say, well, maybe the media is just making too much of what could be kind of a routine request for information. I mean, given the nature of the investigations he was charged with conducting, well, if that's the position I'm in, the first thing I do is subpoena those officials for information. So a subpoena in and of itself doesn't really tell us much of anything, at least in terms of culpability, right?
Well, no, right. It doesn't tell us that there is culpability, but it we know there's some culpability. So, you know, some things we already know quite well. We know that Trump himself called the Secretary of State of Georgia and the counsel for the Secretary of State of Georgia and tried to influence them to find 12,000 votes. We know that people affiliated with Trump tried to organize, particularly John Eastman, tried to organize a scheme to send fake electors to the Electoral College fraudulently. So, you know, we know all these things. So in that context, you know, we don't know exactly about all the communications between the Trump organization and the county officials, but these would be additional pieces of evidence of crimes, you know, where the broad outlines are already well known. So in that context, I would say we know a little more than just that it doesn't mean anything. I think it means something. I think it means that the Justice Department, including Jack Smith, you know, have concluded that crimes were committed, and they're trying to dot all their I's and cross all their T's in terms of collecting all the evidence of it.
You know, in the past, when Jay and I have talked about this, he suggested that Donald Trump may have, like you mentioned, the finding, whatever, 12,000 more votes, that is not necessarily a sign of some sort of criminal intent. If he, in fact, legitimately believed that there were 12,000 uncounted votes for him, and he wasn't asking that those votes be pulled out of the ether, just that they be found, that they were already there. And it's kind of a larger narrative, and I've heard this from Jay and from other folks on the right, saying that, well, Donald Trump's not guilty of committing crimes because he legitimately believes that the election was stolen, and that his efforts and that the efforts of people like Eastman were not illegal. They were just legitimate attempts to overturn, to correct a grave injustice. And I wanted to get your take on that.
Well, I think what you're really asking only goes to proof. I mean, I believe that he knew that it was illegitimate and therefore it was a crime. Now, so I think and I'm sure the Justice Department believes that too. So the question isn't, you know, I think if you're looking at it from an investigation standpoint, the question isn't, you know, is that possible? I think they know and I know and you know, no, that's not possible. The question is, can we prove that that's not possible? And that's why they need to collect all the evidence. But certainly we heard enough during the public January 6th hearings from a lot of people that were working on Trump's election team that they kept telling him again and again and again that the very allegations of fraud that he was raising were bogus. There was no evidence for it. You know, Bill Barr told him that, you know, his Pat Cipollone told him that. You know, everybody who worked for him, who was part of his administration, who looked into the fraud claims, told him they weren't true. And also the Georgia Secretary of State and the counsel for the Georgia Secretary of State and the Georgia governor, you know, all gave him very specific responses to his specific allegations of fraud in Georgia. They told him it wasn't true. He had no basis for believing it was true. Nobody credible told him that it was true. He just wanted to believe it was true. And that isn't a defense. So I think everybody who's being realistic about this knows that the question isn't whether he believed that bullshit or not. The question is, can it be proved that he didn't believe it. And that's why they're chasing after the proof now.
Gotcha. So that helps to clarify things. So at some point you're saying that simply just stating that I refuse to believe anything that was told to me except what I wanted to believe. That is not, unless you're bringing in some kind of weird diminished capacity or some kind of defense, that is not a legitimate legal defense, basically.
Right. I mean, to say I tried to steal the outcome of an election because I simply refuse to believe that I lost.
Yeah.
That would not be a basis for trying to steal the outcome of an election.
Gotcha. Okay. So in terms of, I was thinking about potential charges, right? And it seems to me it ranges all the way from seditious conspiracy, insurrection, witness tampering, I don't know, obstruction of official proceedings. I think I didn't realize this was a potential charge, conspiracy to defraud the United States, because apparently from a precedence like around a century old, I guess Chief Justice Taft has said that, well, the court said that, well, it's not just financially defrauding, but if you try to interfere with some kind of lawful governmental function through, I like this phrase, deceit, craft, or trickery, and that's not okay as well. It is a violation of that. So, I mean, is there anything on that laundry list that you think I'm missing, or things that are more or less likely, would you say, based on what we know now?
You know, I have to confess again, I should have looked into this better before today's show. But, you know, when these issues came up back during the election a year and a half ago, I made a list of all the relevant statutes, but I don't have it all in my head, sure. And I don't have it in front of me right now. But I think you covered the ground for sure, that, you know, that there's, I mean, trying to interfere with official proceedings, particularly with election counts, is a serious federal crime. And I think all these other ones that you mentioned are also potential things he could be charged with. There are a number of statutes that Trump's conduct, I will say, did violate. You know, probably a more prudent way would be say, you know, appears to have violated. Sure, sure. And I don't think that there will be problems finding counts that he could be charged with. You know, once there's enough evidence to show that he tried through various schemes, ranging from submitting false electors to pressuring state officials, to sending mobs to attack the Capitol and interfere with the vote count, that he tried to steal an election that he had lost.
Do you think so? I assume you believe that there will be probably multiple indictments. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't see any other reason that Garland would have appointed Jack Smith. I mean, I don't think he needed to appoint Jack Smith, but I don't think it hurts either. But I think if Garland didn't believe that there's going to be an indictment, then what's the point of appointing Jack Smith? He doesn't need a special counsel to not indict somebody.
Do you think, I mean, my view is that not only would he not have appointed a special counsel if he didn't think there would be indictments, but also that there would be significant indictments. Because honestly, I feel like if the only indictment ends up being about the documents thing, that to me, that might be technically a legal victory, but it seems like not necessarily the kind of political result I think a lot of people would want and would actually potentially backfire. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Garland does hope to bring charges related to January 6th. You know, he hasn't brought them yet, which must mean that he doesn't think they have all the evidence yet and the investigation is continuing. And I think even as late as Wednesday, Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson confirmed that her office, so this is not just a county level, this is the state Secretary of State, received a subpoena from Jack Smith about communications with the Trump campaign during the 2020 election. So the investigation and the evidence gathering is continuing, but I think that Garland's hope is to, you know, get enough evidence to legitimately support, you know, the maximum charges that can be brought.
And to do it soon enough so that it doesn't get embroiled in the 2024 campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of calendar year 2023 will be fair game for that. Yeah. I know Trump thought that, you know, if he announces now that he's a candidate, that's somehow going to mean that nobody can indict him in 2023. But I don't think Garland cares about that at all. You know, I think probably we're talking about after the new year into 24 that would start to become an issue.
Yeah. And so do you see a reasonable possibility that Donald Trump is not just indicted, but convicted? I mean, is that, it's hard for me to, I don't know, he's been such a slippery character for so long, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think if he's indicted, he'll be convicted, because I think Garland is pretty prudent. And I think he wouldn't bring the indictment if he thought there was much of a chance there wouldn't be a conviction. I think it's much more likely that we won't see an indictment than that we will see an indictment, but then see an acquittal. And you know, think about this. The Trump Organization case in New York, which, you know, was, I would say, less of a big deal by far than any of the election related cases. You know, they got indictment. They got conviction on all 17 counts from a New York jury. And you might say, well, New York juries hate Trump, but actually D.C. juries hate Trump, too. And, you know, that's where these cases will most likely be. So I don't think it's impossible. And I think, you know, in the earlier cases against people like Manafort, you know, before he got pardoned, you know, they got convictions out of juries related to some of the same conduct.
So yeah, we could potentially be seeing, I don't know, if a Donald Trump convicted and behind bars or anything like that. It's a scenario I have trouble envisioning, but I know it's a scenario that a lot on the left are kind of eagerly looking for. But I will believe it. I will believe it when I see it. I still think that what's going to happen is that if at best there will be a conviction on the documents charges, but I would be surprised if there's actually a conviction on anything related to January 6th. And so I think in the end, this ends up helping Donald Trump politically, but maybe that's just because I am just become so pessimistic about the state of American politics. I don't know. But all right.
So you actually believe there will be an indictment, but there will be an acquittal?
I believe there will be an indictment and a conviction on the documents charges. That to me seems to be pretty straightforward. It's like Donald Trump practically gifted the DOJ with that one. But on the January 6th stuff, I think it's going to be too difficult to prove. And I just see him getting out of that. So, yeah, that's my take.
Getting out of that by not being indicted or by being indicted?
No, by being indicted, but by not being convicted. And I think that's going to be worse than not being indicted in the first place for the reasons that, you know, you talked about. So, yeah,
I will say, I don't think that'll happen. I think there's much more of a chance he'll never be indicted. I think Garland does not want an acquittal, and he will stop there from being an indictment unless it's really clear they'll get an acquittal.
Well, maybe you're right, because the evidence then would have to be really strong. Yeah. Yeah,
the evidence would have to be really strong. I think Garland's not going to let the case move forward unless it's an open and shut case.
And so you think sometime in the coming year, we will see any indictments probably come down, I would imagine. So depending on how quickly or slowly this moves, especially if Garland wants to make, or sorry, if Smith wants to make sure that all of the I's are dotted and T's are crossed on this, we could potentially be seeing the actual criminal case start or be going on in 2024 during the presidential year.
Yeah, I think it could. I think it would have to start, you know, pretty early in the presidential year. And, you know, and if Trump's able to, you know, he is pretty good at introducing delay. I think if he's able to delay it, you know, into the spring, if the primaries start and he's a candidate, I think it'll end up getting delayed until after the election, but in November. But otherwise, you know, maybe that does make me think they need to speed up the timeline for the indictment a little bit more, because otherwise I think there is a chance of an indictment followed by a postponement of the trial.
Yeah, it should be a very interesting period, to say the least. All right, well, let's stick with domestic politics and kind of presidential election sort of stuff. You know, for, well, I guess half a century now, the presidential primary season has been kicked off with the Iowa caucuses, but that's going to be changing, at least for the Democratic Party, in 2024, because on the recommendation of President Biden, the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee has agreed to reorder their primaries, with South Carolina replacing Iowa as a kind of first in the nation. Now, formal approval of this won't come until early next year, and states will also have to adjust their primary dates to correspond with this new ordering, which brings a wrinkle into this. But the way the order will be, at least if the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee has its way, is South Carolina on February 3rd, followed by Nevada and New Hampshire 3 days later, Georgia on February 13th, and Michigan on February 27th. And, you know, this has been a change that a lot of Democrats have been arguing for, well, for years now, in kind of an attempt to bring more diversity to the early stages of the nominating process. And in the letter that Biden wrote to the Rules and Bylaws Committee, he said, for decades, Black voters in particular have been the backbone of the Democratic Party, but have been pushed to the back of the early primary process. We rely on these voters in elections, but have not recognized their importance in our nominating calendar. It's time to stop taking these voters for granted and time to give them a louder and earlier voice in the process. And so now South Carolina, of course, which followed Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada in 2020, they gave a big boost to Biden's presidential campaign. If folks recall, he finished in fourth place in Iowa. I believe it was fifth in New Hampshire, but he won pretty convincingly in South Carolina and then kind of took off from there. And now the problem is, of course, we don't know how this is going to shake out at the state level because each state sets its own date for primary elections, and New Hampshire and Iowa have state laws requiring that they start the process. And then there's the complication that, well, the RNC voted to continue its current order, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, which is the same as 2020. And so in theory, state parties in states that don't change their primary dates can run their own nominating contests, but it's hard to see that happening in practice because they wouldn't get state funding, the logistical support to run those elections, and I don't really see that as happening. So this is still a little unclear as to how this is all going to work out, but just in general, Ken, what do you think about the change to the calendar that Democrats seem to want to go forward with?
I think the principle of making the change is correct. I'm not sure I agree with their execution of it. So it seems to me that there's no good reason for Iowa to go first in a Democratic nominating process. As has been pointed out, not only is it a non-representative state in terms of who the voters there are, it's a very white state, and the Democratic Party now has very large minority presence. But also, it's a state that's going to go Republican. It's not, once upon a time it was a real purple state, but it's not anymore. So you've got kind of a small non-representative group of mostly older white Democratic voters who may not be reflective of the Democratic electorate nationwide, generally lately picking candidates who don't wind up being the nominee. So I think that's got to go. On the other hand, I don't think South Carolina is the right pick. I think it's being picked primarily because it was the state that saved President Biden. And so he feels a debt to it, and that Clyburn has a lot of influence and he wanted it. But I think North Carolina or Georgia would be much more sensible than South Carolina, because I think that it's you actually want to do this in a purple state. Like you want to let the Democrats in a state that could determine the election pick which candidate they want to be the Democratic nominee. And South Carolina is not such a state, and its neighbor to the north and to the south, but both are.
Yeah. I mean, Georgia does go 10 days, only 10 days later, right? So I think maybe you can make the argument that, well, it's, yeah, sure, not first, but they're pretty far up the calendar. And so they'll still be able to exercise more influence than they would have otherwise. But that, you say, that's maybe not enough?
No, I think that's okay. So maybe if Georgia is going to go 10 days later on Super Tuesday, that's fine. But why not North Carolina? Why not Virginia? I think there's states that provide the same demographic diversity that South Carolina provides, but that actually we would really want to have a bigger role in the nominating process, because we want candidates that can win in those states in November. States where it's possible but not a sure thing that a Democrat could win in November. I'd like to see those states playing the biggest role in the process.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And then one argument that, well, folks from Iowa and New Hampshire have been making forever is that the reason they should go first, even though they certainly can't argue that they're representative of, America as a whole, is that this gives the chance to kind of see that retail politics one-to-one sort of thing. And this is why small states should go first, because they can really get the measure of the person, right? And that has some sort of special meaning and ties to our past and all this stuff. What do you think about those arguments?
I don't disagree with them. I just think they may not be as important as other arguments anymore. I mean, I actually think it's a correct argument to say it's better to start in a smaller state because money will have less of an influence there. That it's whoever coming in with a big monetary advantage can give a big advantage in a big state, because you need to rely on advertising to get the word out. Whereas in a smaller state, it's possible to just get out and meet voters. So I agree with that. And I even agree in New Hampshire's case that it's a purple enough state that it probably should have an early role in the process. It's one of those states that the Dems ideally, you know, would like to win and are not guaranteed to win, although they have been winning it. But I just think that as correct as I think those arguments are, I think they're outweighed by the idea that we need to win certain swing states, and therefore we need to tailor the candidates to those swing states. We need the candidates that will do well in those swing states, because ultimately winning the election is the most important thing.
And, you know, some folks would say, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And sure, you know, Joe Biden struggled in those first two states, but hey, it worked out in the end, right? South Carolina did, in fact, save him, and he was elected. So why do all this and upset so many people? I mean, is this more trouble than what it's worth? And I think there's something to that argument.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually usually a believer in if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I'm not going to say it's hugely broke right now, but I would just say I think there's actually, you know, more compelling reasons to switch than to stay. I wouldn't say the current system is broken, but I would say it seems to me that the current system would be improved if it focused more on bringing the swing states in early. Now, I know South Carolina doesn't completely do that, but I think the benefits of that would be far enough in excess of the detriments that I don't think that the current system has to be completely broken in order to think it could be improved.
Yeah, and of course, there's an important difference between just in general how Democrats and the Republicans conduct their system of primaries, because even though traditionally, they're held on the same day in each state. Democrats award their presidential delegates broadly proportionately to vote totals, whereas Republicans have much more of a winner-take-all sort of system. And there are kind of pros and cons for that. The Republicans definitely wanted a system that could kind of give them a front runner very quickly to have that momentum. And some would argue that it kind of backfired on them in 2016. But what do you think about those differences between, I mean, do you think that the way the Democrats do it is a better way, not necessarily fairer or more democratic, that's one thing, but actually results in the sort of candidate that has a better chance of winning in the general election?
It seems to me that it does. I mean, I think that Biden, I believe, was the most electable candidate in 2020. And, you know, he wasn't even my candidate in the primaries, but I think the system gave a good result. I think in Obama's case, it's obvious what a good result the system gave. And, you know, maybe Hillary Clinton, you know, I mean, maybe you could say, well, she didn't win and she came through that system. But you know, actually, she did win. I mean, she got 3 million more votes than Trump. I don't know who could have been more electable than her in that year. So I think the system's been working fine in terms of how the Dems allocate the electoral votes.
And I would think, plus as an advantage, I believe it's kind of more representative and more democratic in a real sense. And so there's that going for it too, you know, which is nice, I think. So, all right. Well, you know, before we go, I always enjoy doing recommendations, Ken, because you're always reading or listening to or watching something that I invariably put on my list. That's sometimes true with Jay, but Jay is sometimes a little more highbrow for me, and I can't quite get into some of the stuff he asked. But you always have, I think, more approachable picks as far as I'm concerned. So, what do you have for us this week, or for me at least? You know.
Oh. Sure. You know, I think with Trey, I usually do this in the bonus show, don't we? But I'll do it in the regular show. Now, this is actually something I invited you to join me at, Michael, and you declined, but I'll reopen it. So you know how much I love Neil Young. And Neil Young has been, you know, over the course of his whole entire career, he would film quite a lot. And, you know, under the theory that someday he would do something with that film. And one thing that he just got around to doing was 50 years ago, when he recorded the album Harvest, which I believe is his most popular album ever, he had a couple cameramen with 16 millimeter handheld film cameras filming pretty much everything, every rehearsal, every recording session, just everything. And that album was recorded on his ranch in California, and also in a Nashville studio and in a New York City studio, and in London with the London Symphony Orchestra for part of it. And all of that stuff was filmed, and then he just sat on the footage for 50 years. And now, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Neil Young's great album, Harvest, he just released this movie called Harvest Time, where he edited together all that footage. And I went to see it the other day, and it was so fantastic. There's so many revelations in it. You know, if you're a Neil Young fan, you know, I can't even think of anything more exciting than watching the moment where Neil Young is lying on his back with a banjo composing the song that became Old Man.
Oh, wow.
And you get to see a lot of stuff like that in the Harvest Time movie.
That sounds really, and Neil Young is a fascinating guy, right? Then there was a thing, I think earlier, was it this year, where he asked Spotify to remove his music because of a Joe Rogan thing or something. And he just strikes me as being such a iconoclastic, idiosyncratic kind of guy, as in addition to being clearly a great musician, you know. So I think he's just an interesting character.
Yeah, so that's my pick.
Okay. I'll go with something. Well, I just a couple of days ago, I watched a movie just came out called Bullet Train, just for some fun. It's final exam time, and I tend to be kind of burned out at this time of year. And so I just needed something fun and silly, and ideally with ridiculous levels of cartoonish gore. And the Bullet Train is it. It's a new Brad Pitt movie. It's five assassins on this bullet train that's going to Kyoto or something, and a blood and hijinks ensue. And it's a lot of fun. And I was able to turn my brain off for a couple hours. And just, that's what you need, this is what you need, Bullet Train. So there we go. All right. Before we go, just a reminder that Ken and I are going to be doing, well, the bonus show is going to be pretty much all Supreme Court all the time. We have a couple of really important cases, as well as Ken's thoughts on Supreme Court ethics. And I'm really looking forward to those conversations. If you are not a supporter and you would like to hear those conversations, well, you can become a supporter. Just go to patreon.com/politicsguys and sign up, or you can support us on Venmo or at Politics Guys, or through PayPal. And you can find the support links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And just a reminder again, any support that we get during the month of December is going right to Trey for the reasons I talked about at the top of the show. And if you would like to get that midweek show, but you are not in a financial position to support the show, totally not a problem. We understand. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up with that. And whether you're a supporter or not, it really does help if you spread the word. So subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on your podcast app, sharing episodes on social media, greatly appreciated. And if you've got a question, comment, I don't know, weird manifesto or whatever statement you want to issue, you can do that to us at mail@politicsguys.com. There's also our Discord for Patreon supporters, which is always a lot of fun. And you'll find links to all of that stuff in the show notes. And finally, a special thanks, as always, to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.